Another line. Evil French citizens with U.S. visas are stuck in France. So few boats. Rina's father is Jewish, Paul said. Will that complicate things? I went to the Murphy bed and unballed the linens. Since Washington changed immigration quotas in 24, everything's harder now, Roger said. She'd settle for a tourist visa. Roger slammed his desk drawer closed. Would you get away from that bed, Caroline? Everyone in that line out there would settle for a tourist visa, Paul. Rina needs two sponsors.
I can be one, I said, plumping Roger's pillow. Was that lipstick? Rocket red.
Thank you, Caroline, Paul said with a smile. Shouldn't you be helping Pia out front, Caroline? Roger said.
I tucked the blanket edge under the mattress.
Has Rina booked passage? Roger asked. Yes, but without a visa, her ticket expired. She'll rebook when she has the new visa.
Roger turned on his razor and applied it to his cheeks, cleaning up stray hairs. Left to its own devices, that beard would have swallowed his face whole.
I'm not making any promises. More visa restrictions are due any day.
More? I asked.
You know it's not my decision, Roger said.
I lifted the Murphy bed up and into its wall closet. Can't we expedite things? This doesn't seem fair. Paul is a prominent French citizen, an ambassador to the world.
I'm at the mercy of the U.S. State Department, Caroline. A case of champagne only gets you so far. I may go back to France for a visit, Paul said. Go back, and you're back for good, Roger said.
I stepped to Paul's chair. Why not wait until spring?
It will be a very different situation by spring, Roger said. I would go now, Paul, if you're serious.
Paul sat up straighter.
Of course I'm serious.
Was he? I'd given him the re-entry forms, and he'd lost them, twice. Not that I wanted him to leave.
Then you need to apply, Roger said.
I can fill out the forms for you, I said. Paul reached over and squeezed my hand.
You must be eager to see your wife, Roger said.
Of course, Paul said.
Roger stood.
It's up to you, but if you're in your room at the Waldorf when Hitler decides to move on France, you won't be going back.
The meeting was over. Paul stood too.
Caroline, can you stay behind for a minute?
Roger asked. Paul made his way to the door.
See you upstairs,
he said, and left for the roof garden. Roger closed his door.
I hope you know what you're getting yourself into here.
I've sponsored 10 applicants.
You know what I mean. With Paul.
It's nothing, I said. Stay calm. A tired Roger was trouble.
Paul would be gone by now if not for you. I see what's happening.
That's unfair, Roger.
Is it? He has a family, Caroline. Isn't it odd he's in no hurry to get back?
Roger picked up Paul's folder and paged through it. His new show
is more important than his wife.
I think they're somewhat, well, estranged.
Here we go.
Roger tossed the folder onto his desk.
Pia says you two spend lunch up on the roof garden.
No need to overreact, Roger. I stepped toward the door. Little did Roger know, Paul and I had crisscrossed Manhattan together many times over, eaten chop suey and rice cakes on McDougal Street in Greenwich Village, strolled the Japanese garden in Prospect Park.
Look, Caroline, I know you're probably lonely.
No need to be insulting. I'm just trying to help. It isn't right he and Rina should suffer like this. Look at all Paul's done to help France.
Please. You want me to get Rina out so he can stay. Then what? Three's a crowd, Caroline. And guess who'll be left out? He needs to do his duty as a French citizen and go home. We have to do what's right, Roger. We don't have to do anything. Be careful what you wish for, Caroline.
I hurried back to my office, sidestepping a stray pétanque ball. Would Paul still be waiting? Roger's words hung in the air. Maybe I was attracted to Paul. I hoped Betty was right about men and their silhouettes. Did Paul like mine? There were worse things in life. We were terribly busy at the consulate, but Mother insisted I volunteer at the Thé Dansant she and her friends arranged at the plaza. If you've never attended one, a Thé Dansant is a relic of a bygone age, a casual afternoon gathering at which light sandwiches are served and dancing is encouraged. There were a million places I'd rather have been that day, but Mother's Thé Dansant was to benefit her white Russians, those former members of the Russian aristocracy, now exiled, who had supported the Tsar in the Russian Civil War. Helping these former aristocrats had been Mother's pet cause for years, and I felt obligated to help. She booked the plaza's neo-rococo grand ballroom, one of the most beautiful rooms in New York, with its mirrored walls and crystal chandeliers, and commissioned a Russian balalaika orchestra to provide the music. Six of the Tsar's former court musicians, in white tie, sat ramrod straight on risers at one side of the ballroom. Each held his triangular, three-stringed balalaika on his knee, waiting for Mother's cue. Though these world-class musicians had been reduced to playing at Thé Dansants, they seemed happy for the work. The assisting hostesses, committee members Mother had strong-armed, and a few of my junior league friends went about the room setting up in traditional Russian dress. She'd even convinced a sullen Pia to join our ranks. I told no one outside of my fellow hostesses that I volunteered at these gatherings, for it was humiliating beyond belief to be seen in Russian dress. As an actress, I'd happily worn every species of costume imaginable, but this one was too much, for it included the sarafan, an elongating black trapeze-like dress embroidered with bright red and green stripes, and a puff-sleeved white blouse adorned with crewel-work flowers. Mother also insisted we all wear the particularly embarrassing kokoshnik, the high headdress embroidered in gold and silver, set with semi-precious stones and festooned with long strings of river pearls. As if I weren't tall enough already, the headdress made me resemble an only slightly shorter Empire State Building draped in pearls. Mother slid an empty Russian gilt and enamel donation bowl onto the front table, and then placed one hand on my embroidered sleeve. This sent a lovely wave of perfume my way. The one her friend, Prince Machiavelli, a displaced Georgian nationalist himself, had made just for her, with her favorite lilac, sandalwood, and rose notes. He and his actress wife, Princess Norina, sent Mother every one of their fragrances, resulting in a colorful city of cross-topped crown bottles atop her dressing table. "There will be low turnout," Mother said. "I feel it." Though I was reluctant to tell Mother, low attendance was inevitable, for Americans had become increasingly isolationist. The poll numbers showed that our country, still smarting from huge casualties in the First World War and from the Great Depression, was opposed to being swept into the new conflict. New Yorkers were in no mood for Thé Dansants that benefited anyone outside our 48 states. "With the war on in Europe, your white Russians are no longer a priority, Mother." Mother smiled. "Yes, think of all the poor displaced Europeans." She looked at charitable opportunities in the way some eyed a plate of pastries. Our cook Sergei stepped across the ballroom, a pleated toque on his head, his chef's jacket dusted with flour. He cradled a silver bowl of tvorog in his arms, a Russian peasant dish of farmer's cheese infused with blackberry syrup. Born Vladimir Sergeyevich Yevtushenkov, Sergei was descended from some sort of Russian nobility, which Mother had always been vague about. Having Sergei live with us was like having a heavily accented, much younger brother who spent every waking hour thinking up new things to flambé for Mother and me. Sergei's appearance caused Pia to approach, like a crocodile sliding into the water, crystal punch cup in hand.
"That looks delicious, Sergei."
Sergei blushed and wiped his hands on his apron. Lanky, sandy-haired Sergei could have wooed any girl he wanted in New York City. But he'd been born with a crippling shyness that kept him in the kitchen, happily salamandering his creme brulee. "Maybe booking the grand ballroom was a mistake, Mother," I said. The chances of filling over 4,000 square feet with merrymakers were slim. I stole a piece of Mother's khachapuri, buttery bread cut in triangles. "But you advertised it in the Times. People will come." Mother's orchestra played a passionate version of the Russian folk song The Ancient Linden Tree, incompatible with any modern-day dance step. Mother gripped my elbow and pulled me aside. "We're selling Russian tea and cigarettes, but leave them alone. Pia says you've been smoking them with your French friend." "He's not. Your social life is your affair, but we need to make a profit."
"I know you don't approve of Paul, but we're just friends."
"I'm not your minister, Caroline, but we both know how theater people are, especially married actors away from home. But you're a 35-year-old woman, 37. You don't need my approval. But if you ask me, one or two from the orchestra might make suitable beau." Mother tipped her head in the direction of the band. "Once the toast of Russian aristocracy. There isn't one under 60. The picky bird goes hungry, dear." Mother wandered off to drum up donations, and I finished readying the room. I was on a ladder adjusting a spotlight to shine on the orchestra, well aware that being up so high only increased my conspicuousness, when Paul appeared at the ballroom door. He stepped straight to the ladder.
"Roger told me I could find you here."
The grand room suited Paul, the cream-colored walls with gold accents a fine contrast to his dark good looks. I felt a wave of la douleur, one of the many French words that do not translate into English well, which means the pain of wanting someone you cannot have.
"Delightful,"
I said, climbing down the ladder steps, pearls swaying. Could he not at least suppress the smile?
"I'm on my way to the theater, but I need your signature for Rena's visa application. If this is a bad time..."
"Of course not." Mother approached us, and the orchestra picked up their tempo. "Mother, may I introduce Paul Rodier?"
"Lovely to meet you," Mother said. "You're in the streets of Paris, I hear."
Paul gave Mother one of his best smiles.
"Just one of 100.
Mother seemed immune to him. To the untrained eye, she appeared perfectly cordial, but after years of watching her in society, I could detect the chill.
"If you'll excuse me, I need to see about refreshing the khachapuri. Someone seems to be eating it all."
Paul turned to face Mother.
"Khachapuri, my favorite."
"It's for the paying guests, I'm afraid," Mother said. "Not that there will be many of those tonight." Paul bowed a little bow in Mother's direction, so formal with her.
"If you ladies will excuse me, I must be going."
He smiled at me and exited the way he came. So soon.
"Good job, Mother, alienating our one guest."
"The French can be so sensitive."
"You can't expect people to stay here. New Yorkers would rather die than eat Tvorog. And it does help to offer alcohol, you know."
"Next time we'll sell weenies and beans.
If it were up to you, we'd all be out at a bump supper, a jug of corn whiskey on the table."
I turned my attention to hanging Mother's pine garlands above the doorways, assisted by a sulky Pia. As we worked, I mentally addressed the long list of things I was behind on. Reports for Roger, my comfort packages. Why was Mother so stubborn? She had to adapt to the 20th century. I felt someone's gaze on me and turned to see one of the more elderly members of the orchestra, balalaika in hand, wink at me. An hour later, even Mother conceded defeat. Our only potential customers had been plaza guests, a couple from Chicago who'd wandered in by mistake and left quickly, as if they'd happened upon a nudist colony. "Well, this was a bust," Mother said. I pulled a garland down from the wall. "I told you." I didn't finish the sentence, for such a clatter grew in the hallway outside the ballroom we could scarcely hear each other. The doors were flung wide, and a crowd streamed in. Every sort of person you can imagine. From up and down the social ladder, all heavily rouged and dressed in 1920s French attire. Women in low-belted sweater sets, their hair finger-waved. Some wore dropped-waist dresses and Louise Brooks bobs. Gorgeous creatures in satin tea-gowns embroidered with beads and rhinestones. Their hair eaten, cropped, and slick a la Josephine Baker. The men wore vintage suits and bowler hats. A slew of black tuxedoed musicians brought up the rear, violins and saxophones in hand. Mother looked ready to shoot through the roof with happiness as she waved the musicians over to join the orchestra. "We have Kachapori, everyone," she announced. "Leave your coats with dear Pia." In the wake of it all, Paul strode in.
"My goodness, what's all this?" Paul said, squeezing past two women carrying a drum set, cloche hats pulled down over their eyes. I recognized them, of course.
"I think you know, Paul. How did you get the whole show here?"
"You know theater people? They were already dressed for a party. Carmen has a migraine, so no matinee today. We're free until curtain call at 6.
The Streets of Paris pit band mixed well with Mother's Russian orchestra friends and found Love is Here to Stay their musical bridge across the nations. Once the dancers recognized the song, they took to the dance floor. Women foxtrotting and swing dancing with women, men with men. Mother rushed to us, straightening her headdress as she walked. "It's a nice-looking group, isn't it? I knew we'd eventually draw a crowd." "Mother, Paul did all this. They're from his show, the whole cast." Mother blinked, momentarily nonplussed, and then turned to Paul. "Well, the American Central Committee for Russian Relief thanks you, Mr. Rodier."
"Is there any way those things might include a dance? I've never danced to Gershwin played on balalaika."
"Well, we mustn't deprive you of the opportunity," Mother said. Once word leaked that the famous Paul Rodier was at the Thé Dansant, the whole hotel came by, and Sergei had to replenish the Tvorog 3 times. Soon I managed to lose my headdress, and everyone was having a grand time, including Mother's orchestra friends, who'd brought some Russian vodka to liven up the iced tea. By the time Paul left, his pockets were pregnant with Russian cigarettes pressed upon him by Mother, and the donation bowl for the American Central Committee for Russian Relief was overflowing. Mother stopped near me to catch her breath between dances.
"Feel free to collect as many French friends as you like, darling. I do miss theater people, don't you, dear? Such a refreshing change of pace."
Paul waved goodbye to me as he left. A job well done. Off to deliver the cast back to the theater for curtain call. His kindness could not have found a more grateful object than Mother. She hadn't danced like that since Father died. How could I not be immensely thankful to him? Betty was right. He really was my best friend. Chapter 5. Kasha. 1939. Matka screamed as the SS man brought the shovel down on Mshina. After one dreadful squawk, she lay quiet. The only sound, the scratching of her still-running feet against the hard ground. A few butterscotch feathers hammocked in the air.
"That's how we did it back home," said the SS man.
He threw down the shovel, picked poor Mshina up by her limp neck, and tossed her to the skinny guard. I tried not to look at her legs, still scratching at the air.
"I'll let this go," the SS man said to Matka. He wiped his hands on the handkerchief. "But remember, withholding food from the Reich is a serious offense. You're lucky to get a warning."
"Of course," Matka said, one hand on her throat. "Mshina," I blurted out. Hot tears burned my eyes.
"Listen,"
said the skinny guard, holding Mshina upside down, avoiding her talons.
"Mshina means doggy in Polish. They call a chicken a dog. Stupid Poles."
The men took Mshina and stomped out, tracking soil on our floors. My whole body trembled.
"You let them kill her, Matka."
"Would you rather die for a chicken?" Matka said. But she had tears in her eyes, too. We hurried to the kitchen and watched through the front window as the men left in their truck. Thank God my sister had not seen all that. Zuzanna returned the next day, having spent the night at the hospital. Her mentor and hospital director, Dr. Skala, famous for his cleft palate repair work, had been arrested, and she'd been ordered to leave the ward and told Poles were unfit to hold important positions. I'd never seen her so shaken, wild and angry at having been forced to leave her patients, who were mostly children. Later we learned that as far back as 1936, Nazis had been putting lists together of Poles they suspected of being anti-German, and even marking targets like hospitals with giant X's that their pilots could see from the air. No wonder it was so easy for them to take those they wanted. Papa returned as well after 3 days of interrogation by the Gestapo. He'd not been beaten, but he was ordered to work early each morning and spent long hours at the postal center. We were relieved he was alive, but he told us how hard it was to watch the Nazis open packages and letters from the post boxes of Polish citizens and just take what they wanted. They scattered sawdust on the floor after hours to make sure he and his staff did not visit the postal center at night when it was unattended. Soon it seemed every Nazi in Germany rolled in. Our German neighbors went to the streets and hailed the arrivals with salutes and flowers, while we stayed inside. Russian troops stayed east of us, advancing only as far as the Bug River. After that, we were like flies stuck in honey, alive, but not really living. We were lucky the Nazis reassigned Zuzanna to the Lublin Ambulance Corps, since they rounded up all the other doctors at the hospital, male and female, and took them away. They issued her papers, complete with her photo, and stamped with a dozen black Nazi eagles. These papers allowed her to be out at any time, even after curfew. Every morning that we woke up in our own beds, we were grateful. So many of our Polish friends disappeared in the night with no explanation. One day, to keep warm, I sat on my bed, wrapped in a quilt, and took a quiz in an old photoplay magazine, my favorite indoor sport. A student in Piedrik's clandestine economics class had paid him in American magazines, and I memorized every word in them. The quiz said you would feel a click, like the sound of a compact closing, if you were in love. And I felt that click every time I saw Pietrik. Our interests matched perfectly. A rare thing, according to the quiz. Pietrik stopped by that day. It was good to see him. I didn't care what we talked about.
I just wanted to keep him there any way I could. How long can you stay? I cut a picture of Carol Lombard from the magazine. She was surrounded by white poinsettias somewhere in Los Angeles. It was hard to remain casual when I could feel the compact going click. Pietri came and sat near me on the bed. The springs sagged under his weight.
Not long. I came to ask a favor. It's about Nadia.
He looked tired and had not shaved in days.
She had to go away for a while.
What happened? I said, suddenly cold all over.
I can't say.
But...
It's not safe for you to know. But trust me, people are working to change things.
It was obvious to me he was working with the underground. Though he didn't say as much, he must have been among the first to join after the Nazis invaded. I had noticed mysterious late-night meetings, day-long absences with no explanation. He didn't wear the big black boots some boys in the underground did, making them sitting ducks for the Germans. But he was in deep. I hoped it was not so obvious to the SS. Most of us boycotted German orders and sabotaged what we could, but the home army, the Armia Krajowa, or AK, was serious. Though at the beginning it was not yet officially called AK, it represented the Polish government in exile in London. Our exiled government broadcast warnings to us through the BBC and the Polish radio station Świt and all of Lublin's 17 underground newspapers.
If you want to help, you can do me a big favor, Kasia.
Anything.
When Nadia and her mother left, they had to leave Felka behind. The Nazis are doing terrible things to the cats and dogs owned by Jews. Can you go and get her?
Where is Nadia? Can I see her?
I didn't care anymore. She and Pietrik were in love. I just wanted them both to be safe. I can only tell you the Nazis almost arrested them, and they escaped just in time.
For being Jewish? She's Catholic.
Yes, but her grandfather was Jewish, so that puts her at risk. Nadia has to stay away for a while. She'll be fine, but right now Felka's not.
He held my arm.
Will you help? Bring her here.
Of course.
Also, Nadia's mother left something in her nightstand, and she needs to put it in a safe place. A yellow envelope tucked inside the phone book.
I don't know, Pietrik. Nadia's mother always locks up.
The back door is open. You need to take that phone book with the envelope inside it. I hate to involve you because you're precious to me. But I have no one else.
Were those tears in his eyes?
Yes. You know I'll help.
I was precious to him? He took my hand, turned it over, and kissed my palm. I thought I might melt right there, through the floorboards and into the basement. For a moment, I forgot all the bad things going on.
Bring the phone book with the envelope to 12 Lipova Street tomorrow morning just after 10. Ring the bell. Someone will ask you who it is. You say, Ivona.
Is that my code name? Ivona meant yew tree. I wanted a sexier code name like Grażyna, which means beautiful.
Yes, that's your code name. Viola will buzz you in. Just give her the book and tell her it's for Konrad Zagota. Then leave as you came and cut through Park Ludowa before you head home.
Later, when I replayed the scene in my head, I wasn't sure if he'd really said, "You're precious to me." But maybe the photoplay love quiz was right after all. The next morning, I departed for Nadia's house, a fine apartment on the first floor of a two-story building, a five-minute walk from our place. I wanted to do a good job on my first mission for Pietrik. On the way, I stopped at the stone wall next to her house, where we left secret notes and our favorite books for each other. I pulled our special square stone out, smooth, edges rounded from so many years of ins and outs. The last book I'd left was still there.
Kornil Makushinsky's Satan from the Seventh Grade. Our favorite book we'd passed back and forth so many times. Would she have a chance to take it? I left it and slid the stone back in place. I continued on without the least bit of nerves until I came to Nadia's house, that is. Once I saw her orange door, my knees became quaky. Deep breath in, deep breath out. I stepped around back to the little fenced-in yard, peeked through the slats, and saw Felka curled up on the back step. I could clearly see her ribs, even through her thick fur. Nadia's yard was even smaller than ours, a sickly rose bush and a rusted child's wagon the only ornaments. I had a time of it getting over the fence, and then walked slowly to Felka. Was she waiting for Nadia? I stroked her chest, and at my touch, she tried to wag her tail, though she could barely lift her head. She was warm, but her breath was coming in shallow pants. Poor girl was starving. I stepped over Felka, swung the back door open, and crept into the kitchen. From the looks of the Apfelkugel on the table, it had been at least a week since Nadia and her mother left. The milk in their glasses was thick, and the flies had found the plums. I walked through the kitchen to Nadia's bedroom. Her bed was made, as always. I stole through the rest of the house and into Nadia's mother's bedroom. In this room, there was little sign of departure, hasty or otherwise. A white-painted iron bed, covered in a down duvet, took up most of the room, and a crocheted blanket lay at the foot. There was a depression in the down where a suitcase had been, and the Polish copy of Gone with the Wind waited on the bedside table. Two tapestries showing country scenes, a small crucifix, and a calendar hung on the wall. The calendar showed a smart-looking woman standing in front of a locomotive, a bunch of yellow flowers in her arms, with "Germany wants to see you" printed across the top. It also featured the name of Mrs. Vatroba's travel agency. Vatroba Travel. Let us take you there. I opened the bedside table drawer, found the phone book, and paged through it to find the fat envelope. It was sealed, with the word Zhegota written on the front in a spidery hand, the color of money faintly visible through the paper. I took the book, pulled the blanket from the foot of the bed, and retraced my steps back through the kitchen, where I grabbed a loaf of shiny, braided egg bread from the table. It was rock hard, but any bread was precious. I reached the backyard and struggled Felka into the wagon. She barely made a peep, poor girl. I set the phone book next to her, smoothed the blanket over it all, and trundled off toward Lipova Street, taking side streets to avoid Nazi guards. When we were almost there, we picked up speed, and the wagon bounced over the cobblestones.
"What have we here?"
An SS brown shirt stepped out of an alley and startled me no end. I saw a girl from my gymnasium class standing behind him, but she retreated into the shadows. I almost fell over. My knees jellied so. "Just heading home," I said in German. Thank goodness I knew German, since all conversation in the Polish language had been banned.
"Ah, German, are we?"
He lifted the blanket with his nightstick. "No, Polish." The officer ignored me and walked around for a closer look at the wagon.
"What is this? A dead dog?"
I could barely hear him. My heart was thumping so loud in my ears. "Just sick. I hope it's not catching." The guard dropped the blanket.
"Move along," he said. "Get that sick animal home."
He disappeared back into the alley. By the time I arrived at the office on Lipova Street, I was soaked through with sweat. It was a busy road. I left Felka covered in the wagon and walked up the steps, legs shaking like the aspic on Matka's gastrocarp. I was finally, officially, a spy. At just 16 years old, an enemy of the Nazis. There was such power in that. I stood a bit taller and rang the bell. What was the code name of the one who would accept the package?
Viola.
Who is it? Came a voice from inside.
It is Ivona, I said.
I looked back at the street, cars and horse-drawn wagons driving on their way, people on the sidewalks.
Hurry, Viola. I could be spotted by the SS there with my telephone book for all the world to see.
The door buzzed. I entered and closed the door behind me. I recognized the girl with a code name, Viola.
Janina Grabowski,
from my former girl guide troop. She held all 10 fingers splayed, each tipped with wet ruby lacquer.
Sorry I didn't answer the door straight away, she said.
I held out the telephone book. Viola, this is for Konrad Zegota. Janina was a good sort, with hair dyed flame red and a farm girl build, but not my first choice for a partner when risking my life. She didn't have one serious girl guide proficiency badge in first aid or orienteering, and everyone knew she'd gotten her art badge for doing makeup. Janina took the book between her palms.
Thank you, Ivona.
The office was in a converted apartment building with tall windows that overlooked the street, covered only with transparent white drapes. It was furnished with one metal desk, an old typewriter atop it, two easy chairs, and a dusty table scattered with outdated Polish fashion magazines. Someone had placed a glass bowl on the table. Inside it, one goldfish. The goldfish, suspended in place with his fins beating, stared at me, mouth agape in a surprised, "Oh!" Even he could tell this office was a fake. Janina flopped the telephone book onto the desk. A smile teased at her face until she burst out with a loud laugh.
You can't expect me to keep a straight face, Kasia, Ivona. This is all so funny.
The name Pietrik had given her, Viola, meant violet flower. Not a fitting name for her, since she was a tall girl with wrists thick as table legs.
Keep your voice down. Who knows who's nearby watching?
The overhead lights were so bright. Were we lit up for every Nazi to see?
The only Nazis that have come anywhere near here followed Anna Sadovsky when she was carrying grenades in her bra. Flirted with her the whole way. Some girls get fun jobs.
Janina stepped closer.
Stay for cards?
Cards? There's money in that book. Shouldn't you hide it? Do you want to get a shot?
Come on, stay. I'll do your hair.
I need to get home before dark. She clutched her hands to her chest.
An updo?
Janina worked part-time at the best hair salon in Lublin. Pietrik told me to leave right away.
Are you two sweethearts?
I have to go.
Everyone says he likes you.
I hurried to the door. Don't listen to rumors. Janina picked a magazine from the table and slid herself up onto the desk.
So, you're not interested in any rumors?
I turned.
Even rumors about, say, Nadia Vatroba?
I stepped toward the desk. What do you know?
Janina thrust her chin in the air. Oh, now you'll stay.
She's my best friend.
Oh, really? Janina said, flipping through the magazine.
Would you stop? Her dog is outside waiting, very sick.
She slapped her magazine closed. Not Felka.
Nadia's Felka was a famous dog.
Yes, Felka. So tell me now.
Well, I only know a little. Janina, if you don't tell me...
Okay, okay. All I know is that Pietrik, well, I think it was Pietrik,
took Nadia and her mother to a safe apartment.
Close by?
In Lublin, yes, but that's all I know.
Nothing else?
Just that I heard she's somewhere right under the Nazis' noses. Dazed, I thanked Janina, walked back down the front steps, and started for home. Through the park, as Pietrik had told me. Nadia really was safe. My whole body relaxed as I pulled the wagon quicker to get Felka home and fed. Nadia was with her mother and still in Lublin. There was much I could do for her. Care for Felka. Keep working for the underground.
After all, my first mission had gone well even if Janina hadn't taken it seriously. Was I now part of the resistance? I delivered money. I would take the oath tomorrow and make it official.
Halfway home, the skies opened, flooding the cobblestone streets, soaking Felka and me through.
You were lucky once, my wet shoes said with each step. Don't make a habit of it.
Chapter 6. Hertha. 1939 to 1940. I took the train home from Camp Blossom, happy to leave, my thoughts fixed on finding a job as a physician. I wore my BDM uniform, but before long regretted this. It would have been restful to watch the thick forests fly by outside the train window, assembling a mental checklist of possible clinics to visit. But I did not get a moment of solitude, for every passenger stopped to display admiration for my uniform.
"May I touch your eagle, please, Fräulein?"
a young boy asked. He stood at my train seat, posture good, arms by his sides, rocking slightly as the train swayed. His mother stood behind him, two fingers to her lips, eyes wide, as if meeting the Führer. Yes, it was somewhat burdensome to represent the BDM, but flattering as well, since great respect was shown to those of us in that uniform. As young people, we had such power. "You may," I said. Water came to my eyes as he stroked the gold thread with the touch of a butterfly. Nothing grips the heart like an unspoiled German child. It was understandable my uniform caused a fuss, since most Germans had never seen the full complement of BDM badges on a woman. While the all-male Hitler Youth had patches and pins for every activity, down to potting plants, BDM achievement badges were limited in number and hard won. On my navy blue leader's jacket, I wore the Red Cross patch, the silver proficiency clasp for nursing, and the first aid and physical fitness badges. But it was the eagle indicating the highest level of leadership, the golden bird worn over my heart, his bullioned wings fanned out, which attracted the most attention. Mutti had cried with pride the day I first wore it home. She'd been more impressed with that than my diploma from medical school, accelerated on account of the war. Once home, I tried to find my first job as a doctor, but even though I'd graduated second in my class, practices were reluctant to hire a woman doctor. It seemed the party rhetoric about a woman's rightful place being at home raising children had taken root, and many patients requested a male physician. Since, as a female university student, I'd been required to take needlework classes, I took in sewing work for extra money. I finally found a part-time post at the skin clinic of Düsseldorf, which paid a small fee for each patient I treated. It was a dull job, the highlight of most days lancing a boil. Would I forget the few surgical techniques I'd learned in medical school? A surgeon must operate consistently to stay proficient. Our economy had improved markedly by then, which only reduced the number of patients seeking skin treatment. Even dishpan hands, once the bread and butter of dermatology, were not a problem for most German housewives anymore. Polish laborers provided by the Reich, imported from the East, took care of the scullery work. As a result, my earnings soon dropped to almost nothing. Father's condition went from serious to critical, and Mutti had to stay home with him. I barely sustained all three of us. In no time, I became the only starving doctor in Düsseldorf, so I continued to work part-time at Onkel Heinz's butcher shop. After the stillness of the Camp Blossom woods and the quiet clinic, the bustle of the crowds coming to the shop for their meat, the anxious Hausfrauen in their ironed house dresses jostling to the counter like a polite herd of cattle themselves, was a welcome variation. There I could escape my troubles and just tear great sheets of white paper from the roll and practice surgical knots as I wrapped packages in striped twine. I came to work as usual one Sunday, when the shop was closed to the public. That was the day Heinz had me work there alone, so no one could see what I made for him. His special project. "Hurry up," Heinz said. He pressed himself against the butcher block table, which sagged from the blows of his cleaver and his father's before him. His bulge was plain even under his butcher's apron, which was stiff with dried calf's blood. How did I get myself in such a fix? Years of being too afraid to say anything. That is how. Heinz watched as I stood at the work table and chose the tautest lamb intestine. The waiting was the best and worst part for Heinz. I turned the tissue inside out, macerated it in bleach, and removed the mucous membrane, careful to leave the peritoneal and muscular coats. Uncle Heinz urged me on, but I took my time, since any tear or pinprick could spell disaster. "I'm going as fast as I can," I said. It was best to stall, for once I finished, the worst part came, and the whole process began again. Bad thoughts stung me as I worked. Why wasn't I home researching new jobs? It was my own fault I was stuck there, trapped by Heinz, fearing he would reveal our secret. I should have told on him years before, but Tante Ilse would never have paid for my schooling if she'd known. What would Mutti say? I could never tell her, of course. Even sick as he was, Father would murder Uncle Heinz if he knew. This was the price I paid for my education. Heinz said I brought it on myself, a young woman, alone there with him. Heinz moved next to me and lifted my skirt. I felt the familiar creep of his calloused fingers onto my thigh. "Why does it take you so long?" Heinz asked. I smelled that sweet wine he liked on his breath. I pushed his hand away. "Things take time." Heinz was not exactly the cream of the master race. With an IQ somewhere between borderline deficient and mildly retarded, he was easily put off by any excuse more than two words long. I patted the delicate tissue dry, measured, and cut. Heinz was red in the face by the time I rolled it down, smooth and clear as a silk stocking. I didn't have to be told to go to the meat locker with the tin bucket of lard. There was a curious comfort in the sameness of it. I pulled the string attached to the bare bulb to illuminate the space and braced myself against the coal wooden shelf behind me. Even with the flour sack across my face, I knew what was coming. The sweet flour smell cut his odor of beef blood, cigars, and bleach. "Don't cry." Crying only angered Heinz and made it take longer. He inched my handiwork over himself, dipped one paw into the lard, ran it down the membrane, and began. I reviewed the bones of the hand. One, the scaphoid bone, derived from the Greek skaphos, which means boat. Folds of fat hung from Heinz's abdomen like a hairy apron and flapped against me with each thrust. With his irregular breathing coming faster, it would not be long. Two, the lunate bone, shaped like a crescent moon. I had long ago stopped wishing for a sudden heart attack. Years of fatty roasts must have provided him with arterial plaque buildup 2 fingers thick, but he managed to stay alive nonetheless. Three, the triquetrum bone. Four, the round pisiform bone named for the Latin for pea. Heinz could not contain himself and began his usual moaning and so on, his breath a cold fog on my neck. His hands shook as he gripped the shelf, his thick butcher's wrists supporting his weight. Without warning, The refrigerator door opened, and the flour sack slipped from my face. Ilza stood in the doorway, holding the door open with one hand, a jar of marmalade in the other. She must have heard Heinz groaning like a stuck pig.
"Shut that door, woman," Heinz said, pants puddled at his ankles, face purple.
Was that disgust on her face or just weariness? She placed the marmalade on the refrigerator shelf, turned, and left. The locker door chunked shut behind her, and Heinz went back about his work. One slow day at the skin clinic, I sat at my desk after finishing with my last patient, a rotund 4-year-old thumbsucker. I'd sent his mother home with some antiseptic cream for a rash. How would I make a living doing this? I was much better suited to the tranquility of a university position, but a teacher's salary would not support my family much better. I picked up the Journal of Medicine and noticed a classified ad for a doctor needed at a re-education camp for women 90 kilometers north of Berlin near the resort town of Fürstenberg on Lake Schwedt. There were many such camps at the time, mostly for the work-shy and minor criminals. The idea of a change of scenery was appealing. A resort town? I would miss Mutti, but wouldn't miss Heinz. The only other thing I knew about the camp was that Fritz Fischer, my former medical school classmate, worked there, but it had a pleasant-sounding name. Ravensbrück.
Chapter 7. Caroline. December 1939. Christmas Eve day, Paul and I made it over to the Fifth Avenue skating pond in Central Park. I loved to skate, having learned on Bird Pond near our house in Connecticut, but rarely practiced, since I avoided most activities that made me look taller than necessary. Plus, I'd never had anyone to skate with before. Betty would have rather swallowed live bees than be seen on skates. I vowed to take full advantage of Paul's time in New York. It was perfect skating weather that day, clear and sharp with a stiff wind, which overnight had made the ice smooth as the finish on a billiard ball. As a result, the flag atop Belvedere Castle was up, the red sphere on a white field every skater coveted. Word that the ice was ready passed from doorman to doorman along Fifth Avenue, and the pond became thick with skaters as a result. The first tier of skaters was already there when Paul and I arrived. The men, near professionals, performed their genuflections and whirligig spins, icicles on their beards and noses. Then the ladies arrived, two or three at a time, their heavy coats like sails blowing them across the ice. With a little practice, Paul proved to be a serviceable skater, and arms linked, we glided throughout the network of adjoining ponds. My old self never would have skated in such a public place, but I tackled the ice with vigor, and we soon found a nice rhythm together. Suddenly, I felt like trying every sort of new thing. We sailed under arched bridges to Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata and Waldteufel's The Skater's Waltz, which couldn't have sounded lovelier, even transmitted through the skate shack's tinny speakers. The ice grew more crowded, so we skated back toward the shack, the scent of warm chestnuts in the air. We were about to sit and change out of our skates when I heard my name.
"Caroline! Over here!"
It was David Stockwell. He skated to us and stopped with a sharp edge and a smile, posing like something out of a Brooks Brothers advertisement, drawing his jacket back with one gloved fist. How could David act as if nothing had ever happened between us, as if up and marrying an acquaintance after stringing me along for 10 years was completely natural?
"Hey, who's this guy, Caroline?"
David said. Was that a flash of jealousy? David did seem small by comparison. Would he think Paul and I were romantically engaged? Slim chance of that. Paul was keeping his distance,
and gave off only friend signals, not even standing close to me. What if he did show David I was his? Thinking about that made me wish it were true. Paul extended his hand.
Paul Rodier.
David shook it.
David Stockwell. I've known Caroline since...
We really must be going, I said.
Sally is over there lacing up. She'd hate to miss you.
I'd had advance warning about Sally from Betty, of course. Her new sister-in-law was a petite girl whom Mrs. Stockwell had showered with a haute couture wedding trousseau, the cost of which could have fed half of New York for a year. I gave David my best "we really can't stay" look. He turned to Paul.
I'm with the State Department, working to keep us out of the war. Heard about your speech at the gala. Seems you're working to get us into it.
Just telling the truth, Paul said.
It was our most successful event ever, I said. Paul skated closer to me and linked my arm in his.
Yes, darling. Overwhelming, wasn't it?
Darling? David blinked, taken aback. I moved closer to Paul. Deafening applause. And the donations. Everyone's behind France now. Sally Stockwell skated toward us through the crowd. It was hard to ignore the smallness of her, maybe 5 feet 2 inches tall. She was done up in full skating costume, boiled wool A-line skating skirt, a snug little quilted Tyrolean jacket, and white fur of some kind at the top of her skates. The yarn tassel on the knitted cap she wore, tied under her pretty chin, swayed as she neared.
"You must be Caroline," Sally said.
She stretched a white angora-mittened hand out to me, and I shook it. Sally was more Olivia de Havilland than Betty Davis, and impossible to dislike, with a disarming honesty that made even the most trivial conversation awkward.
"David's told me everything about you. Caroline helps French babies. Caroline and I starred in our first play together."
"I was Caroline's first leading man," David said. "Played Sebastian to her Olivia."
Paul smiled.
"They share a kiss, don't they? How were the reviews?"
"Lukewarm," I said. Sally skated closer.
"Sometimes I think you and David should have married."
"So good to see you both," I said. "Sorry to run off, but we have to be going."
"Yes, spending the whole day together. Aren't we, sweetheart?" Paul said.
He was laying it on thick. That would activate the gossip mill, but I didn't care. It felt good to be loved, if only for show. We said our goodbyes and waved to Sally and David as they merged into the flow of skating couples. How lovely it was of Paul to pretend to be my beau. He was not mine to flaunt, of course, but it was still nice to have someone in my life to show off, especially to David Stockwell, who'd so thoroughly trampled my ego. After skating, Paul went back to the Waldorf to change, and I decorated the fat blue spruce Mother's bosom friend Mr. Gardiner had brought down from the country and made coq au vin. Sergei had sent down a winter vegetable soup from Connecticut, loaded with sugar parsnips, fat carrots, and gorgeous sweet fennel for our first course. That night the snow, which had hit Connecticut earlier, made it to Manhattan with a vengeance, leaving Mother stranded with Sergei up at our country house. Paul arrived at my door with snowflakes in his hair and on the shoulders of his overcoat. His face was cold against mine as he leaned in to kiss me on each cheek. He'd gone heavy on the sumare, once one of my father's favorite scents. I'd peeked in Paul's medicine cabinet at the Waldorf when I used his bathroom, and seen the bottle there beside the blue jar of Noxzema. Paul held a bottle of burgundy and a nosegay of crimson glory roses wrapped in white paper. I would need to keep my wits about me and watch my wine intake. I was relieved he'd dressed up in his aubergine jacket, for I was wearing a dress and silk stockings. He slid the bottle, heavy and cold, into my hands.